Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 2nd, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Mary Carlson with Dan Spencer. Today's session number is 99-6, and it's titled Bioethics and Faith, Physician-Assisted Suicide. Let's listen in.
Welcome to the first of our week-long series called Bioethics and Faith. My name is Mary Carlson. I teach social work at St. Olaf College and have 20-so years of medical social work experience, including sitting on a lot of bioethics committees, long-term care, and acute care.
My name is Dan Spencer. I teach religion and ethics at Drake University in Des Moines. I don't have nearly the history that Mary does, but for the last 5 years, I have been sitting on the Central Iowa Health Systems Bioethics Committee, so I've had a chance to do some of this stuff there.
We have a couple goals for this week that I want to share with you. The first is to teach some usable concepts and language so that lay people, people of faith, can discuss amongst each other some of these really tough issues that we are faced with, have been faced with, and certainly will be faced with in the future. And then to encourage people to really grapple with the issues by thinking through them more carefully than we often do when we read something in the newspaper, hear it on TV and sort of go, oh, that's terrible, or oh, why doesn't she do that, or something, but to think through a little more carefully. So we're going to use a case study approach. The title each day will have an idea of what that case study might be, and we're going to try to get through several cases this week. Our challenge will be time. But both Dan and I are probably J's on the Myers-Briggs, so we'll do as well as we can. Let's just get a quick idea here. How many folks are healthcare providers? Bunch of you. Okay. How many people have had some experience with an ethical decision in the healthcare setting, personal or professional? Okay. How about clergy here? A bunch. Anybody a philosophical ethicist by training? Okay. Dan's going to start with a real brief overview of the history of bioethics. It'll be very brief.
Well, let me just start. Bioethics is very simple. The term bio means life, and ethics is thinking about questions of right or wrong or morality. So bioethics is simply the broad field of thinking about the ethics around life. It oftentimes has to do with life and death issues. I like to think about it as the ways we intervene in our bodies. For better or for worse. And so that's oftentimes end-of-life issues, it's beginning-of-life issues. It deals with genetic engineering. Do we alter life? But when we intervene in the sort of natural course of how our bodies play them out, whether that's illness, genetic engineering, those things, it brings up ethical issues. How do we think about what's right or wrong and what gives us guidance in that area? Now, For at least the last 20 centuries, 20 plus centuries, there has been one fairly standard ethical code in the West that's guided that. And those of you who are healthcare providers, what's that? The Hippocratic Oath, and based in do no harm. We'll talk more about that. But the Hippocrates gathered a group of physicians, healthcare providers around him many, many centuries ago, to talk through what are the duties, what are the ethical requirements of healthcare providers, particularly physicians, and came up with the Hippocratic Oath. And by and large, for the last 22, 23 centuries, that has been an adequate guide. But in the last 30 or 40 years, all sorts of new questions are coming up in the field of healthcare, field of our bodies, that simply could never have been contemplated by previous generations. Artificial organs, transplants, these kinds of issues. And what has changed the field of bioethics has been the introduction of technology. Technology has been changing possibilities of life and death decisions in such ways that we are presented with options and choices that simply were inconceivable to the many generations before us. So beginning about the 1950s, people began to recognize there needed to be further guidance in at least two areas. One was the ethical, theological, philosophy area. How do we have guidance to think through these things? And the other was the area of the legal area. What kind of policy or law should govern these kinds of issues? And so bioethics conversations began initially as sort of a three-way conversation between healthcare providers, especially physicians, theologians and philosophers who have been accustomed to thinking about issues and questions of meaning in life, and then the legal system, lawyers and judges. More recently, a fourth group has come in very strongly into the discussion, and that are the patients themselves. Interestingly, very early on, patients tended not to be consulted much because much of the medical profession operated on the principle of paternalism. But with the patients' rights movement, patients have become the fourth very involved in that area. And so we'll give a little history as we go through some of the different issues. But that's what we're talking about really is just one or two generations old, but has very ancient roots.
When we teach bioethics, it's important, I think, to consider there are really two levels always going on in the study of and application of bioethics. One, which we're focusing most on this week, is the individual case study, looking at what's going to happen to this person, this family, in this situation. The other, which will come up starting today, every day, is the policy issue. In social work, we refer to micro and macro. So that is, what are we going to legislate? What is the norm in the community? What is the practice principle for healthcare providers? So always those two levels are happening, and we just need to say those will sometimes come into conflict. But we need to have awareness of both levels.
One of the things about that is that bioethics oftentimes operates much like our legal system does, that based on precedence. So once you set a precedence in an area, whether it's a legal precedent or simply an ethical precedence, those are oftentimes the reference points for future decisions. And so what it means is every individual case has social ramifications.
Through the week, we're going to use a list of common terms and some principles that we've defined in a way for this week. So we'd like folks to start using these terms in similar ways. We're going to leave these up through the week and refer to them each day when we're together. We're going to very quickly go through them because they'll come up periodically and we'll elaborate through the week here and there. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on the definitions, but we want to go through them quickly. Morality and ethics are often confused. Some people use them interchangeably. Morality, we like to think of, however, broader as really anything that's dealing with choices and behaviors relative to what's right and what's wrong, simply speaking. Obviously, philosophers unpack that in great detail. Ethics, then, which we're trying to teach and talk through this week, is a more systematic way of formulating the use of moral principles, rules, and standards. That is to look at who we are and how we act in light of our values, and to do that carefully with formulations so that it is applying what we are thinking about in what's right and wrong. It's important for our conversations this week, and especially at bedside when we're talking about an ethical situation, to understand whether it's an ethical issue or, which we'll come to in a minute, an ethical dilemma. Because an ethical issue, we consider any course of action, including my talking with you right now, that involves the well-being of humans. In bioethics, we talk primarily about human, and Spencer teaches environmental ethics also, so that gets into the animal and plant kingdoms also. But any course of action between people is about ethics and is an ethical issue. A value we talk about as being a deeply held belief or commitment. A value can be positive or negative, and not every value has a place in ethics. For instance, I, as a mother of young children, value sleep. That's not necessarily something that would come into play in ethics, although I suppose it may. But we're talking primarily in ethics about a deeply held belief that people come to out of whatever grounding, theological or philosophical, is important in their life.
Just a couple of things. Another thing you think, the whole realm of aesthetics, if you value beauty, would be an example of things that are important values but not necessarily ethical content. And the other thing, just to keep in mind about whether it be positive or negative, if you think about, say, the Third Reich, Hitler, that society valued racial supremacy, white supremacy, which most of us today would evaluate as a negative value. But so a value can have any content, both positive or negative.
Okay. Then the next two concepts, rights and duties, are often viewed in connection to each other, the flip side of the other. A right being a justified claim to something which others must respect. Our country is certainly based on rights. And this gets very important when we're talking about bioethical considerations. a justified claim to something. A duty, on the flip side, is an obligation held by a person or an institution to meet the rights of others, perhaps. So rights and duties often come together and are related to each other.
Okay. We're going to be focusing a lot this week on what we call as ethical dilemmas. And ethical dilemmas are simply situations when our ethical values, our principles, or our actions in any situation come into conflict. Right? Now, ethics is much broader than this, but much of clinical ethics or bedside bioethics involves these ethical dilemmas. See, I'll give you one brief example. How many of you have ever been involved in a relationship which assumes some degree of confidentiality? Right? Where confidentiality was simply assumed. Now, how many of you have had a situation where something came up in that relationship which you thought, wow, I wonder if this justifies breaking confidentiality? If you're in counseling, someone says to you, tomorrow I'm going to harm so-and-so. Or if you're a parent and someone sends something to you in confidence, but you realize this poses harm. So you've got a situation where you both want to respect confidentiality, but you want to prevent harm, or you want to prevent something else. You've got an ethical conflict. How do you decide what to do in that situation? So much of what we'll be focusing on are some of the ethical dilemmas, these conflicts, where you want to do the right thing, but you're going to have to make a choice of one value overriding another, or one principle or duty doing that.
And we talk about that being a conflict within a person. I can have my own ethical dilemma, or a conflict between parties. Be either one.
Now, we talked before about ethics being systematic ways of doing this. As a result, there are a variety of different ethical theories, and which will try to provide some consistency, some coherence. We're not going to spend a lot of time this week on them. You may hear the terms like utilitarianism or deontological ethics, which is a duty-based or principle-based. Or you may have heard of virtue theory. What's most important is to instill virtues in ourselves and then let people interact that way. We'll point them out as we come up. But what they do is help us to provide some consistency. The approach that Mary and I are going to show is what's called a mixed or a contextual-based approach, which tries to draw on the strengths of each of these. It recognizes that principles and duties are important, but so are consequences. And so how do we think through both valuing the duties, the principles, the values, but also thinking about potential consequences that come up? And then just two forms of value that will be coming up in our conversations that can be helpful to keep in mind. One is what we call intrinsic value. Intrinsic value is simply the value something has for its own sake, quite apart about how useful it may or may not be to someone else. And so bioethics starts from the premise that human beings have intrinsic value. Every one of us in the room, simply by being born human, has value. And that will become a very important bottom line assumption about how we think about then treating each other. But a second one that can come up sometimes in important ways is what we call instrumental value, the value for this one has for the sake of others. Sometimes this comes up in fairly negative ways. Like you'll say, you're only treating me instrumentally. You're only treating me as the value I provide for you. You're only treating me because I'm going to carry your pack up to a certain part here. But you're not thinking about the value I have my own sake. But instrumental value is very important as well because, for example, parents have instrumental value to their children. This does not in any way minimize their intrinsic value. It simply recognizes that in particular relationships, we have value to others because of the duties, the rights, so forth, that come into that. And so that can be important sometimes when we think through how to resolve a conflict. Now, we've gone through this very quickly here, and we're going to leave this up all week and keep referring to it. But are there any questions of clarification or things that are not clear about some of this basic grounding?
You want to say responsibility since you skipped it?
Oh, did I skip responsibility? Sorry about that.
We're holding each other responsible.
Accountable.
Pieces,
yes.
Of this, yes.
Mary talked about rights and duties being sort of reciprocal dimensions of a relationship. Responsibility is a broader area than, say, a duty. Responsibility is a task or an area for which an individual or an institution is accountable. So we can talk about a government is responsible for the welfare of its citizens. Or parents are responsible for the welfare of their children. That will have several duties within it, such as feeding them, clothing them, educating them. But it's a broad area. And so when we talk about healthcare professions, there'll be certain areas of responsibility that have specific duties within them as well. Thanks, Mary. Yeah, thank you.
Can we ask questions about anything?
Yeah, Deb, if you got some questions or clarification, we are going to move us along quickly so we can have time for the case, but...
Number five, a justified claim is something which others must respect. That just seems to be explosive in terms of, because you hear so much today about individual rights.
Yep. What part of our Constitution... Okay.
The term justified claim is, on the one hand, that says you must respect, but I may not agree that it's a justified claim.
And that's where lawyers and judges and courts come in. That's why we have a legal system. What part of our Constitution has this?
The
Bill of Rights, all right? So I have a right to freedom of speech, right? We say that's justified. Why? Because all human beings are created with value. As we talk about in the Declaration of Independence. But does that give me the right to yell fire in a crowded theater? Are there times we have to constrain or constrain rights? Rights of freedom of religion. Does that give me the right to sacrifice people as part of my religion? And we just had a court case in Florida where Santeria was valued that they could sacrifice animals as part of their religion. So any of these are going to, you've hit exactly the right term. Is it a justified claim? How do we decide that? Who decides that? And then we're going to see that's going to be central, very central in the case we're going to focus on today. Are these claims justifiable or not?
The other place we have to be as clear as we can is that there are legal justifications and moral or ethical ones. And we're going to try to keep us focused on the ethical ones, keeping in mind the laws. But the fact is, many of our laws over the centuries have been found to be unethical and therefore are changed or are not followed by certain people. Okay, basic principles that we're using this week, we thought we should go over briefly. And Spence's friend Beverly Harrison at Union calls these action guides. Principles are action guides. That's a useful, quick way to think of principles. And it's really the cumulative wisdom of the ages. Now, we've decided to use this principles approach because it is the most commonly used in our country to make decisions at the bedside. These top four, well, really down to five, Justice, are the ones most commonly used in ethics committees, when people talk amongst themselves, in churches. So these are the words that we think it's important you be familiar with. That is not to say it's the only way to think through ethics, or that there isn't tremendous argument about whether this is the best way to do it or not. It's the way Mary and Dan have chosen to do our week this week. These principles primarily, however, have their grounding in a fundamental principle to most people, which is a respect for persons, which Dan has touched on a little bit. That is, humans, by virtue of being human, have intrinsic value in and of themselves. Persons must be treated as ends and not instrumentally as means to another end. This, however, does raise questions when we get to situations where persons define respect for life as respecting the quality of an individual person's life, or respecting that person's life at all costs, even on machines, artificially keeping the organs functioning. So both arguments can use respect for life as a fundamental grounding. And so that really is what most discussions come down to. So out of these come the big four, as they're known, the Georgetown mantra, after the two people, ethicists, who coined these and really spelled them out for us all. Non-maleficence, I practiced that one, is the Hippocratic Oath tradition. Do not harm. Do no harm. Fundamental for most people, including most healthcare providers. The flip side of that, and sometimes put into the same category because they're really the two sides of a coin, is the principle of beneficence, which is to promote well-being. And we very purposefully use the term whole well-being because that, in our understanding, does not just mean physical well-being. It means emotional and psychological and spiritual, which is also a controversial notion, that beneficence should include spiritual or religious well-being, spiritual in a broader sense. Then autonomy is probably the phrase that most of you have some familiarity with, and up till probably the last 5 or 10 years, I would say, this has been the principle in medical ethics that has trumped every other one, because we are so rights-based in our society. Autonomy is about the right to choose and to self-determine. I get to decide what you do to me. And that sits at the bottom of many of our practices in medical ethics and is being challenged by many. So we'll come back to that. There are several ideas under autonomy that I just want to mention. The first is informed consent. That is the law that says, if before you do something medically to me, you tell me what you're doing, what the risks and benefits are, what I might expect will happen, so that I can make an informed choice. That's what that's about, saying yes or no once I know the information. That comes right from autonomy. Decision-making capacity is the more helpful term for what we commonly call competence. Is somebody able to decide yes or no about some medical intervention? Competence isn't a useful term because people are competent in one way and not in another. Some of us can balance our checkbooks and some of us can't. So competency gets really fuzzy. Decision-making capacity has three parts. One, a person must be demonstrated to be able to understand the information provided. Understand it. That implies a certain level of intellectual ability, and that's controversial, of course. Secondly, that person must be able to make a decision. And third, and this becomes very important with people with certain kinds of severe strokes and other disabilities, that person must be able to communicate the decision he or she has made. So taking information, make a decision, and communicate it are all part of decisional capacity about a particular issue. It doesn't mean you have decisional capacity in your whole life, which is competence, sort of broadly defined and in legal terms, but this is about this decision. Can you make a decision? And third is this notion of surrogacy, which is making a decision on behalf of another person. And there are really two concepts within surrogacy that are important. One is that of substituted judgment. If I am unable to make a decision, don't have capacity for a particular situation, who will make that decision for me? And substituted judgment means that person decides based on what he or she believes I would have decided. So that's the first one.
So that's where like a living will would
that's
come
where,
in.
That's right. That's where I talked about that last week. Those kinds of advanced directives are really helpful to surrogate decision makers. If people have no idea what Mary Carlson would want and she doesn't have decisional capacity, the next kind of surrogacy is making a decision for me in my best interests. What you think might be best for me, not what you think I would think was best for me. Yeah.
In a medical situation, who is it that evaluates whether or not a patient has
this? Isn't that a complicating question? I have been asked to help evaluate that in long-term care as a medical social worker who happened to know a patient extremely well. But it's usually a physician and or a psychiatrist, but they always call in mental health folks too. It could be a psychologist, a social worker to help. If it came down to a court case, you got to have a physician. And that's usually, ideally, a psychiatrist. But those folks often don't know who they're talking to, so they say, well, you know Mr. So-and-so. When he says yes, does he mean yes? When his thumb goes like this, does that mean yes or get out of my room? So it's often a joint decision, family and providers. But it's an excellent question to ask.
So is there family usually involved, if possible?
Depends on how family-oriented the providers are.
Family
I'm a social worker, I think so. But not always.
And but family definitely tends to be involved in the actual decision making. Once, if surrogacy comes in when the decision making capacity doesn't exist, and that tends to be at one or both ends of life for infants and children. So your child is not going to make the decision whether she or he has her tonsils out. You as a parent are. Or end of life, if you have a parent who's developing Alzheimer's or other situations where they're incapacitated, or that in between stages, say someone is in a coma and simply can't make this, and then you're in the realm of surrogacy, and parent and the immediate family usually is the first ones who are consulted in that.
Yep. So for decisional capacity, not usually a family deciding, but that also brings up the issue of people who are who never had capacity. People who are born severely intellectually impaired always will have surrogate decision makers, parents, or later on perhaps guardians, state guardians. So we can come back to that. Okay, the last of the big four is justice, which is gaining in credence and gaining in discussion and writing a great deal in our country, notably because of healthcare resources. But justice generally, for our purposes, refers to fairness in relationships between people. We like to use the terms equity and reciprocity rather than equality very much, because it's pretty hard to treat people equally when people are all unique. So it gets a sort of complicated to know what that means. But justice is really about fairness as we get into it.
It has quite a bit to do with resources as well. For example, much of our history, if you were to compare the access to healthcare resources of the African American population with the white population, there's clearly inequity going on there. So it has to do with fair access to resources. Now, I realize we're moving through these fairly quickly because we want to make sure we give you time with the case, and we're going to be learned by doing today. But some other principles that come in that are oftentimes invoked as subsidiary principles. One is either privacy or confidentiality. This moves out of respect for persons and autonomy, and it's based on the premise that individuals should control private information. That your doctor, your healthcare provider is going to have access to a lot of very private information about you. You should have the right to decide whether or not that is made public. But again, this gets very controversial. What about if you're HIV positive? Does your physician have the right or the duty to make that information available to others? Or do you have the right to say, no, I don't want it? But confidentiality is the norm, except in extreme cases, that you should have the right to that. Honesty and fidelity are characteristics that mark the relationship between the healthcare provider and the patient, the individual. If you're a patient, you have the right to assume that your healthcare provider is being honest with you and will not betray your trust. Okay, you should be able to assume that. Again, there will be difficult times where this comes up. What if you're a healthcare provider and you find out that your patient has a particular condition where if she finds out about that, it will really harm her mentally? Whereas if you withhold that information for a month, she has a good chance of recovering to the point where she'll be at a good place to get it. Are you deceiving her? Are you breaking that fidelity relationship by withholding information? Or are you harming her if you give her that information when she's not ready for it? So it's not always clear cut how these work out, but they're the basic guidelines in most cases. Now, number 9 is one that's oftentimes very controversial, but we use it all the time for making public policy, and that is the principle of utility. You make decisions that will lead to the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And you can see why legislators would be very interested in this one. They have to make decisions that are going to benefit the greatest good for the greatest number of people to maximize social well-being. The difficulty is that utility doesn't do a very good job with individual cases. There's always going to be exceptions in there, so it's an important part of the conversation. But it may end up treating people for their instrumental value in ways that we don't find acceptable. And finally, burden-benefit here is simply in cases of extreme situations where the patient has to make a decision about whether a potential treatment, the burden that's imposed by it, the potential benefit that's gained by it outweighs the burden. One example I think of is patients who have severe burns. And oftentimes the therapy for them is many, many months and many, very, very painful. A patient may simply decide, look, the burden that's going to impose on me, what I will have to go through, is simply not worth the potential benefit. Would you please just keep the pain down and let me go? But burden benefit is judged always in relation to the person's whole well-being from the patient's perspective. It's not that I can say, well, look, grandma's been a real pain in the rear. She's got this situation. She's more of a burden than a benefit, so let her go. Right? That's not what we're talking
Never
about.
Happens.
Right?
Never happens.
So this is always judged from the patient's perspective in that area.
Okay. We're only a few minutes behind. I tell my students that these models are not recipes. And so I tell you that this is a model that Dan and I happen to like and use in our own teaching. We credit Ron Hamill, who was at the Parkridge Center, thank you very much. Prior to that was at St. Thomas in St. Paul. With this 6 and now we add 7-step method that I'm going to briefly go through. It's what we're going to use all week to look at our cases. Now, I will also say, as I say to students, there probably are some of you right now grappling with an ethical decision or an ethical dilemma, but most of us have luxury at Holden Village to sit and chat about this stuff, and that's why we're here. That's why I love teaching here. When there is a dilemma that has to be decided now or yesterday at the bedside, this is a luxury But I believe firmly and strongly that if we have practiced this, then when we have to decide in a split second, we do a better job. Families, individuals, ourselves, and healthcare providers. So that's why I find models very useful. You find 11-step models, you can find 45-step models probably. This is a simple one. It's divided into two sections. I'm going to do the first one quickly and then down to the next. The first is analyzing the situation. Step one is gathering relevant information. This is where people get stuck. Because if you're like me, I want more and more and more and more and more. And isn't there something more I could use to make a decision? But often we don't get enough. This means define terms in the situation. Do we know what physician-assisted suicide is and what it means? Do we know who all is involved, who every player is? Do we know perhaps in this one the worldview of each player? So we ask ourselves, what is the information that's crucial to the decision? Secondly, identify whether this is an ethical issue or an ethical dilemma. And that's important. That takes some people who've had some training in ethical decision making to help understand that. Is there truly a conflict between two principles or two values in this situation? Or is this about communication was pretty bad? I was talking to Peter Lundholm, who's on an ethics committee at the VA, and sometimes people just haven't talked to each other clearly, which can be an ethical issue, but it isn't a dilemma per se.
This is the one I find about 90% of our consultations that were requested as an ethics committee are
Stop
really
right
about
here.
Communication
yep.
styles. And so we clarify that and move on. It really isn't an ethical dilemma.
That's right. Okay, and third, generate alternatives and consequences. Now, what's important here is that we tend to narrow ourselves. Based on what I know, here are the only options available. One, two, or three. Maybe just one. Here I tell my students, get creative. Throw out anything you can think of. That is a good alternative, in your definition, or a bad one. Just kill the guy. Get people to say stuff like that so it's out there. Talk about good and bad alternatives. Talk about short-term ones and long-term ones so that people really have a whole list of stuff that we could do. Now, I might not want to do that one, or you might think that one's bad, but put it out there so we've really thought it through. That takes some work, and that takes some time. So those are the first three when you analyze the situation in itself.
Now, let me just briefly mention that we move into that. That's all just simply setting up the analysis of the situation. From there, we really begin to move into the moral assessment, moral again in terms of what's right or wrong, better or worse possibilities. Now, part of the number two, when you're identifying the ethical issue and the dilemma, is you need to get a sense about which of these principles are actually involved. You're very rarely going to have a case when all 10 of those principles are involved. You may, for the example, the one I gave you before involved confidentiality versus duty to prevent harm. Not preventing harm, but there was no question involved necessarily about justice in there. So you need to identify which of these are involved in the case and why. And then what we start to do is to assess them is you take the list of alternatives and likely consequences and begin to assess them in terms of how they help us with the values. Are we upholding justice? Are we upholding respect for persons? Mary gave that throughout the one there, well, just kill the guy. Right? Most likely, we're not going to uphold most of our values there. So you can begin to assess them in terms of which are better or which are worse alternatives and consequences. Very important one is to assess the underlying motive. I threw out one here before. The very same physical act can be either ethical or unethical depending on the motive. Grandma's hooked up to life support. Looks like she might not get better. On one hand, I'm the beneficiary of her $1 million policy. Pull the plug. On the other hand, Grandma gave me a life directive, an advance directive ahead of time saying, under no circumstances keep me this way. Pull the plug. Very same physical action, very different ethical content. So motive in many cases can be very important to keep clear why is it that we want to be doing this. And the final step then is you have to finally choose, and this is the one my students hate. They love doing all the analysis, but actually forcing them to say, okay, now you have to choose one.
Well, they don't hate choosing. They hate the next.
Well,
justifying.
Then you have to go by and say, okay,
he looks for ethical arguments
now,
and
why?
Things.
Why did you choose that? Why did you rule out all the other ones? Why did you choose this one as the best one? And then Mary mentioned the seventh step, and that is this is an ongoing process. We often have to come back and revisit our decisions later on, or you're confronted with a new case where you revisit it. So it's not a one-time thing. We keep working through this over and over.
And related to that, ethical dilemmas are still dilemmas after you've chosen an alternative and justified it. They're still dilemmas. I say to my students, you still feel it in your gut, and if you don't, you either aren't looking at it carefully or it really wasn't a dilemma in the first place. So those of you who think you're going to have the answer to physician-assisted suicide in 15, 20 minutes here, forget it. There's not an answer per se that you won't struggle with. You'll make a decision. You'll make a choice.
I think we only have enough for about every other person to take one of these, and I'll send some to the balcony as well. So if you'll be willing to share here, we're going to read over the case together, and what we'll try and do this week is do step one together. Gathering the relevant facts and information. Mary's going to read the case so that we have it recorded on the tape. But then we're going to give you about 15 minutes in groups of four or five to talk with each other about it.
And while I'm reading it, either listen or read it yourself, but be kind of quietly getting into groups of four or five if you could, as long as the tape can hear me. And ignore that it says case study number two. We changed our order after we talked.
Everybody have access to one?
Okay, Margaret is a 64-year-old widow who has suffered from Alzheimer's disease. After months of prayerful consideration with her 40-year-old daughter, she has decided that she wants to end her life. Prior to her diagnosis with Alzheimer's, Margaret has worked as a volunteer at the local geriatric center where she became very familiar with end-stage Alzheimer's. She told her daughter that every time she walked out of the center, she prayed that it would not happen to her, but slowly she began to realize that it had. The neurologist who diagnosed her Alzheimer's told her, quote, there is no treatment, and referred her to a psychiatrist because Margaret's own mother had taken her own life after her children had grown up and left home. This had devastated Margaret, and she had sworn that she would never do this to her daughter, but she felt that Alzheimer's was different. Margaret had insisted on living alone as long as possible so as not to be a burden on her family. But after 5 years, the Alzheimer's had so exhausted her that she was forced to move in with her daughter and her family. By this time, she could no longer pursue any of her interests. Getting up was a chore. She could no longer read because she didn't know what the words meant. She forgot words and was embarrassed to speak at length. She could no longer recognize the denominations of money. On several occasions, she could not remember her deceased husband's name. She no longer wanted to shower, woke up confused, and became incontinent at night and began to hallucinate during the day. She developed angina in addition to the arthritis and glaucoma, which were chronic but under control. Her hearing was also impaired and thus increased her difficulty in communicating. Margaret and her daughter approach you, her physician, with the request that you assist in ending her life. She's a Christian and does not fear death. She does not want to die alone and fears that if only her daughter assists her, something may go wrong that would increase the psychological burden on her daughter. Her daughter fully supports her mother's decision, but does not want to assist her suicide alone for fear of botching it. Setting aside the legal issues, is it ethical for you, a physician, to assist her suicide? If not, why not? If so, why? And would you assist the suicide? Now, you won't get through all that, probably, but that's our case. And we're going to start with the first step together. Knowing what you know there, what else do you want to know?
First of all, what is physician-assisted suicide? What are we talking about here?
We have a few docs in the audience that probably have this memorized.
Anybody? Well, how does physician-assisted suicide differ from, say, active euthanasia?
Providing a means for...
Providing the means, but the patient, herself or himself, is still actually carrying out the action there. All right? So notice one thing. Physician-assisted suicide, I'm going to just help us here, presumes autonomy. It presumes that the patient is capable of making a decision and acting on it, but the physician provides the means. That's different than active euthanasia, where the physician actually carries out the act.
You know, I'm a little confused about whether she can make a decision or not. And I would like to get some more testing. I mean, if she's this bad...
We're going to presume autonomy. Okay. She is not end-stage Alzheimer's.
But that is one of the things that you as a physician are going to have to evaluate. She's coming to you, maybe in this moment of lucidity, she's saying this to you, but clearly there's other times when she's not. Mm-hmm. That's part of the situation you're faced with.
Part of the brain.
What right do I have to take her life?
That's for you to decide.
Information. What else? Information. Facts, do you need?
Does she have a living will?
Good question. Yeah, she doesn't really need one at the moment if we assume she has decisional capacity about this. But it might be something you want to ask and make sure her daughter talks with her about.
You can assume that she's talked about this with her daughter.
That she doesn't want to go through Alzheimer's to the very end.
Yeah.
She may have that on paper, which would kind of make, maybe change how you do your...
Yeah, so then if she doesn't have decisional capacity and has an advance directive that was clear, then you're the surrogate and it's clear.
One or two more questions, then we're going to turn you loose.
Other family members, brothers, sisters, who are diametrically opposed to her being handed over.
Very important situation. Is she the lone daughter or are there many others? I'm not going to tell you.
There was no mention of a pastor or spiritual guidance in this report.
Okay. Who else is involved here? Is there somebody else that could be brought in? Notably a pastor or spiritual guidance.
The doctor told her there was no treatment. If she sought a second opinion or explored hospice care or something else, that would make her more comfortable.
Right. Is that really true that there's no treatment for Alzheimer's? Or is there not some treatment for Alzheimer's? There are some things happening.
Right, we got to turn them loose.
Yep, soon. Okay. We got
How big is the estate?
How big is the estate? that's very good. And we said setting aside the legal questions, but you would want to ask whether there are laws about physician-assisted suicide in your particular state, for those of you who are Oregonians, and we can come back to that. Okay. Split up and do your best if you could to at least get through these first four steps, yeah. If you can.
Spend some time. Which of these principles do you think are involved and why? Which ones are relevant? And then is there an ethical dilemma? Is there a conflict between some of these for you as a physician in there? And then if you can get to the point of what would you do and why, great. And we'll give you only about 10 or 12 minutes. You're going to have to move quickly.
Great to do large group conversation and debriefing about this. So
I apologize ahead of time. My students oftentimes accuse me of being the conversation Grinch. Just when they really get going in their small groups, it's like, all right, cut, come on.
And you have our promise, fidelity. You can trust that every other session this week, you will have more time in your small groups. We really need to get through some of the preliminary stuff. So I have the way that we're going to do this in the remaining time. Allow me to be a Grinch. First off, I want people just to yell out the principles you decided were involved in this situation. Which of these were involved? We're going to list those first.
And with a brief reason why.
Autonomy.
Because?
She has a right to determine the quality and existence of her own life.
And her death. Implicitly, okay?
Non-maleficence.
I practice that. Malfeasance might do it too. Yes, non-maleficence. Because?
Our doctor has the right to do no harm.
Okay?
Not only right, but
the duty. The duty to do no harm.
Justice and fairness.
Okay?
What will the family or the doctor be exposed to in terms of legal issues?
Okay. Sure. Justice and fairness.
Respect for persons.
Okay? Because?
Because the woman who has the illness feels she has no value anymore. And yet there's intrinsic value.
Now, let me just put a question. This is one where it cuts both ways. Do you see respect as her quality of life or sanctity?
Yes.
The perspective is that she would see her quality of life not being there, so we would respect it that way, but it can go both ways.
Are we talking as physicians right now, or what are we talking
about? No, ideally, we're talking as physicians, but we purposely put that, because that's the hardest. Put yourself in the shoes of a physician. We've got a bunch in the audience, but not everybody is. I think it's easy to say, well, sure, let them do it, but I wouldn't. That's why we decided to say, what would you, if you were to die? Yeah, so that's a good question.
Any other principles?
I think beneficence.
Because?
To promote the whole well-being of the entire, the daughter and the mother, find alternatives maybe to mitigate some of the negative things that she's finding as she progresses in her illness.
Now let me point out one thing here, because it's easy sometimes to confuse beneficence with utility. If you're starting to bring in more people and talking about the daughter, the family, the greatest good for the greatest number of people involved, you're in the realm of utility. If you're talking about the person herself, in this case Margaret, What is her whole well-being? Is it ending her life? Is it continuing on with these issues? Beneficence deals with the patient by themselves. There's some overlap, but it's helpful sometimes to keep them clear, too.
So doesn't burden benefit come in there, too, then?
Yeah. From the point of view of the patient herself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, my understanding, Mary can correct me on this, my understanding burden benefit tends to be of treatment. The patient has to decide whether or not to accept a treatment. If the burden outweighs the potential benefit, then it can refuse it.
Oh, I was thinking the treatment in this case was physician-assisted suicide.
Yeah.
And what is the burden if she doesn't take that treatment?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's interesting. I hadn't heard of PAS talked about as a treatment. But I bet we'll get there. Yeah.
I mean, that's been usually people have ruled that out because of non-maleficence, right. But that's part of their question. What is harm in this case? Mm-hmm. Is it harm to end her life? Is it are you engaged? Are you at least passively participating in harm to have her keep living that way?
And yeah. Is it harm to withhold the medical prescription and the instructions, yeah. That kind of thing? Okay. Other principles that we've missed?
I was thinking of burden and benefit in the aspect of the burden. The mother, Margaret, felt she was going to be a burden on her daughter, and that was the reason for her decision. So the burden and benefit in that aspect enters into it.
Yeah, and Dan's right that usually in the ethics, the discussion is burden-benefit of treatment or not treatment, but then people use the word all the time, I don't want to be a burden. And that goes into their own sense of respect for person. My quality of life does not want to include being a burden.
Where do other choices fit in? I mean, if there's other choices for other kinds of treatment, that doesn't seem to fit in here because that's part of it.
That does come down to generating alternatives. One of the alternatives is what would you think about?
Medicines to relieve her anxieties.
Or if it's interested in third-party care, like a nursing home or a care
center. Yeah. Let's, if we've gone through each of these, any of the other principles involved, this is flying in the face of our saying, usually there are just a few primary principles involved. But go ahead, they're all complicated.
Does utility become involved if she has an estate that is going to provide education for her grandchildren?
This is a big one that comes up sometimes. You know, if I have to live 5 more years in constant pain and suffering and drains my whole estate, I don't want to do that. I would rather end now. I've had a good quality of life, and I'd like to leave that for my children, or leave that to my church, or leave that somewhere.
I might call that a secondary principle that comes back to quality of life for me. And part of my quality is knowing I'm leaving money to help my grandchildren have a good life. But that's just the way I might interpret it.
Here, let's take one more, but then let's hear what people are deciding and why, because that's we're going to be out of time soon.
Well, Bob, do you want to add?
Mary, one of the problems I have with this is that one of the things that the case doesn't really sound real to me is that most people who have Alzheimer's who are this far gone are not uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Their families are.
Yeah.
She might have been uncomfortable 5 years ago. By the time you're incontinent, hallucinating, most of those people don't have the wherewithal to ask that question. And most of them aren't uncomfortable. Everybody else is.
Well, and I'm not going to...
about the burden on anybody.
Yeah, it's why we took out end stage, because we wanted to leave the grayness of whether she has moments of real clarity, which people with Alzheimer's can have all along.
You lose your bladder and bowel function. You're waking up. I mean, you're right down on the ropes.
Yeah.
And she has angina.
Most of those people aren't carrying on any kind of discussion.
Okay, so for those of you who don't think that she really can know, let's assume she left instructions in an advance directive. But we need to move along too, because this is all useful and helpful, and you'll continue it at lunchtime. What's the conflict? Primary dilemma. Which principles are conflicted? Somebody name.
Well, autonomy as well.
Autonomy versus. Non-maleficence is probably the primary one. Others that come up, though?
Fidelity and beneficence.
Fidelity and beneficence? Yeah.
Am I going to be truthful to the Hippocratic Oath, or am I going to work for the person's betterment?
Yeah, and one thing we talked about is we probably should add integrity here, though that comes out of virtue ethics in some ways, but the integrity of the healthcare professional is often in conflict. So we probably should add that as another principle, even under principles provision.
I think number three is also an issue. Promote whole well-being, because you're talking about the well-being of three people or more rather than the patient alone.
But in this case, one of the things to remember, beneficence has to do with the patient.
The person, him or herself, just the patient.
If a healthcare provider, that's where your duty lies, is with that patient.
Where does the
utility is where we talk about.
And there's a lot of debate about whether or not that should enter the conversation.
About the doctor.
Yeah, so that doesn't mean to not consider it, but to not confuse it with the beneficence, which is for the patient, him or herself.
Without having explored all the other alternatives, it's hard to know whether we certainly answer the beneficence issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there may be an even more basic conflict, and that might be between what we could call ethical principles and moral principles. It seems these ethical principles are quite secular, humanitarian, but don't we have a larger consideration whether man even has the right to take life or to make that decision?
Well, that's really here. That's really the confusing between quality of life and sanctity of life. And in some religious traditions, sanctity is referred to as vitalist, which means life is life is life no matter how we're keeping it going, because God gave it to us. So I might argue that there is theological grounding for all of these. We're presenting them without a lot of theological language. Would you?
Yeah, and I would agree. And I think that's what they'll take on a different character depending on whether it's for a Jewish community or a Christian community or Buddhist. I think many of the principles are common across those, but they'll have different reasoning for them. Yeah, but that's a very excellent point, because the conversation may be shaped very differently depending on the theological or religious commitments.
Yeah, some might say, I believe do no harm is because life is God-given, and use those words, still saying do no harm, non-maleficence.
But you can also hear the other people argue the mercy argument and say, look, at the heart, God is a God of mercy. God would never want my mother to go through this. And therefore, based on God's mercy, we could end the life. I mean, you can hear the theological arguments coming in on both sides.
That would certainly have to be the first consideration before we could even get into these others.
And I think for the families in particular, having talked that through a little bit ahead of time is really important.
Let's ask if any group got to a decision. Yes or no? Yes.
No.
No.
Yes. Why not?
Yes, no.
Because they're not explored intermediate alternatives vis-a-vis hospice or nursing home care.
Okay, so presuming that those were not explored, that would be the alternative to go with them, you're saying.
All we know is that the neurologist says there's nothing they can give to reverse it. But that leaves a lot of other things wide open.
Others say no for a different reason than that?
We said no, but I was in a group with a psychiatrist, an endocrinologist, and an oncologist.
Either that means we discount you or we listen intently.
We need more information. Could this person be hypothyroid?
One in every group. It's very useful.
There's some reversible causes of dementia here. Is this person depressed?
Delirium, medication problems. Yeah, I think that this week, according to Dan, we have more doctors in the village. Don't have accidents. They're here for retreat. But it's a nice week for them to be here, us to be teaching, because there is a lot of fertile ground for conversation. So please seek out some of these docs.
Now I'm going to lay out a challenge as well, because both of my parents are MDs, so I feel like a little say this, but I find MDs are really, really talk through autonomy until, but boy. Paternalism sneaks in right at the end. At root, doctors always will know best.
So does maternalism.
Yeah. Does maternalism. Thank you, Libby. Especially if you know my mother.
That's right.
Your mother.
I mean, there is a tendency. We respect autonomy until it disagrees with what we really want.
Right.
And then what do we then?
Because we're past time, frankly, right. But others want to add. Yeah.
One interesting way to help keep that from sneaking into the picture is for an ethics committee meeting where a dilemma like this comes up, is to have the family there and have them voting just like you do. And it really helps protect against paternalism in that setting. It's a wonderful field where everybody around the table is on equal footing, including the patient if they're able and other members.
Before I get right here, I think that's absolutely critical that people be really involved all the way through. Let me just say a couple of things. I'm really heartened that both of these came up, that we need to explore other alternatives and we need more information before making this kind of decision. But let me ask this way. Can any of you conceive of situations where it would be ethical if you had explored this and you got the information and the family or the patient were still saying, I understand all that, but it's my decision, I don't want to go any further. Would it ever be ethical for the physician to participate in ending that life? This
nods.
Is where the big divide comes down sometimes.
Here. Yeah. How many from Oregon? A bunch. Anybody from Oregon?
No. Now we're not talking legal. We're talking ethical.
Ethical. Mm-hmm. Ethical.
Can you do it if you change the disease, like see what people think if it's a pain and suffering disease versus Alzheimer's?
Say Lou Gehrig's disease, where it's pretty clear what's going to be happening to you, where you can watch yourself deteriorating. It's terminal.
Quickly terminal, like Alzheimer's.
Right. Maybe this isn't necessarily the best case, but this is one that increasingly many of us are going to be faced with.
Would it be changed with age? 94 rather than 64.
24.
When we have 2 hours, these are the ifs. Well, what if it changed this way? And what if we did know all this information? And they explored every alternative. And what if she was a he? And what if it was a person of color and poor? And what if... Yeah, those are really useful.
And part of the basic gulf that ends up a lot of times is there's a philosophical school that simply says, look, medical practice is based in do no harm. That doesn't mean it wouldn't be ethical for other ways, but doctors should not be involved in ending their patients' lives. And it's simply, and once you start allowing that, then you're on the slippery slope to what we all know the horror stories of Nazi Germany where doctors were actively euthanizing. Well, it started as a mercy argument. In Nazi Germany, it started elsewhere. So people will say, look, this is the bottom line. You doctors should not be involved in ending their patients' lives. Others argue, say, look, no one is better qualified to know when we reach that situation, has a relationship with the patient, and can be involved in a humane way of bringing that to a close. So some people argue, let's create a special category, only certain physicians.
Or licensed in PAS, a new board certified specialist.
But these are the sort of the philosophical divides that people have to grapple with. Will we be changing what it means to be a physician in a fundamental way if physicians are allowed?
But there's also a reality, mm-hmm. and that is that it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Turn up the morphine.
I read a study that 20 to 30% of ICU nurses say, yes, I have participated in physician assistance.
So is it better to legalize it, bring it above board, and simply have some checkpoints and they can safeguard it? Or do we keep the value in place of sanctity of life symbolically, hope that will minimize it, but recognize it's going to happen?
The Social Work Code of Ethics, we had a policy that came up for the National Association of Social Workers that says, if you are asked as a professional social worker to sit at the bedside, to be there, to support family, support the person, that is ethical to do by our code of ethics in social work, though an individual may elect not to do it based on his or her own philosophical or theological tradition. Fascinating. Said, do it. People ought not to have to be alone in these situations.
Yeah. When they turn off the morphine, is that suicide or euthanasia?
Comfort care. That's
not. It's good.
Well,
they do it now, and they do it.
When Margaret made her decision, she should have. This is going to happen. She should have joined the Hemlock Society and provided her own instrument. And she still had her brothers take care of it and did not burden her children.
But she doesn't want to do that because her mother burdened her.
And would that it would always be so clear, but it's. I mean, we all know life is really messy that way.
Last time we did this, we had a botched suicide attempt.
Well, and somebody brought up the point: is the morphine drip? Is that if you turn that up, is that now if you move into active euthanasia? Well, there's all sorts of people have talked about the doctrine of double effect. If you're turning up the morphine because you're intending to lower the pain, and an unintended consequence is that the person will die, then it's ethical. But if you're turning it up with the intent that the person will die, it's unethical. Well, is that just splitting hairs? Yeah. Or is that really a relevant difference?
Dan has to go do dish team. You better get going soon.
But we need to let people hear.
People have to eat.
We need to call this closed, but Mary, do you want to mention what some of the upcoming sessions are?
Sure. We're doing a couple of interesting organ donation sessions, one involving a living donor who can't decide himself, one involving anencephalic infants, and we're doing a genetic testing case. Would you test your kid in this situation? If so, when would you tell the kid what you found out, that kind of thing? And the last one is human cloning.
About future technology stuff. So we'll eventually be working through all of these different issues.
Back.
So thank you very much, and we will see you, we hope, tomorrow.